Thank you. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Tuesday, April 22nd, 2025. We have six cases on our calendar today. Three are set for oral argument. This is the second of those three. This is A24-1748, Larry Walters et al. Versus Kyle Stromstad et al. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellant if you so choose. We do have a clock in the corner, so please be mindful of the time that you have for your oral arguments. This is being streamed via Zoom, and it is also being recorded, and a recording will be made available to the parties within the next day or two. However, no other recordings of this proceeding are permitted without court permission. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Michael Studer. I represent the appellants, Larry and Karen Walters. Your Honor, I raised several issues on appeal here, but at its core, this case is about a contract that everyone agrees wasn't fulfilled. And somehow at trial, the party who failed to perform that contract won. At trial, the respondents admitted they did not pay their full amount of rent under a valid written sharecrop lease. So with sharecrop leases, in place of a fixed rent amount, what happens is a landowner and a tenant farmer share in the crop proceeds from the crop produced on the land as rent. That was the arrangement in this case. The landowner, Mr. Walters, was never paid his full share of the proceeds from the sharecrop agreement in 2021. Now, the district court nonetheless denied judgment as a matter of law. It excused this non-payment from the respondents based on an oral modification, something that the statute of frauds does not permit for leases for more than 1 year. That error is why this appeal is happening. That error, along with the prejudicial conduct at trial, requires this court's reversal. So today I'm going to focus on three of the issues raised on appeal: the judgment as a matter of law as it relates to the breach of contract claim, the misconduct at trial, and the amendment to the pleadings. For all other issues, I would defer to my briefing unless the court has questions. But first, with respect to judgment as a matter of law in terms of the breach of contract, as I mentioned, Mr. Walters did not receive his full share of the crop in 2021 under the party's sharecrop agreement. Larry and his wife, Karen, own land in Polk County. In 2016, they rented the land to respondents Kyle and Bruce Stromstad. The parties executed the sharecrop agreement. They signed it. They agreed that each year they'd split the crop. Respondents would receive 2/3 of the crop proceeds, and then Larry would receive the remaining 1/3 of the crop proceeds. This agreement was good for 5 years. It was signed, contained all relevant provisions, contained a merger clause, had a provision regarding written modifications only. And in 2021, the last year of the contract, Larry did not receive his 1/3 share of the crop.
So, counsel, you argue that there can't be an oral modification to a written lease. And you rely on the statute of frauds for that. And the statute of frauds requires that a lease be in writing if it's for a period of longer than 1 year, but it doesn't address modifications necessarily.
Well, Your Honor,
there is case law, a case out of this court, Alexander v. Holmberg, 410 Northwest 2nd, 900, that says a written, and this is dealing with a lease that, or a real estate contract, that says a written contract may be modified after its execution by the acts and conduct of the parties. Parole evidence may be admitted to explain the party's subsequent conduct to a written agreement. And then went on to hold that basically that you can have a modification of a lease. through conduct, including oral agreements. So, or conduct, I think, could include an oral agreement. So here, the district court found that there was a modification through the party's conduct and an agreement to bring the grain to the elevator and split it 2/3, 1/3. And you don't discuss any case law in your brief, so I'd like you to address the case law because I'm not sure the statute of frauds by itself answers the question for us. We have to look at the case law as well.
And yes, Your Honor, that is what I'm relying on is the statute of frauds. And I guess with respect to the case law you've noted, I guess I take note of that. I do rely on the statute 513.05, which, I would argue that, I guess I don't have case law, and I apologize for this, but I would argue that this modification, the district court notes, was essentially this was the agreement all along. And that was kind of what came out at trial, that this agreement to split the grain at the grain elevator was what was in place from the get-go. Obviously more than 1 year, so the life of this contract for 5 years. And I guess that's the basis for why I'm arguing the application of the statute of frauds, given, I guess, the length of the modification.
But counsel, I'm looking at 513.05, the statute, and it talks about a contract being formed needing to be in writing, and it's a relatively short paragraph. It says nothing about modification of a contract that has been formed in accordance with that provision, so that statute. So I'm struggling as well as to why the statute doesn't seem to address modification of agreement at all.
And you're correct, Your Honor. And I guess I'm relying on the general concept of this modification is in and of itself an agreement. And I do note that statute does not mention modifications in particular. But I'm nonetheless indicating that that should have application here because this oral modification was essentially its own agreement.
So, assuming there can be an oral modification of a lease that's in writing, how did the district court err in its analysis of the JMOL issue?
Well, and I do think that's important because I do think, regardless of this oral modification, it doesn't necessarily relieve the obligation to pay rent. Assuming that was part of this agreement, was this oral modification, there's no indication that failing to create or open an account at the grain elevator was a material breach, whether that excuses non-payment altogether, where respondents, like in this case, could just run away with part of Mr. Walter's rent. So I guess with the statute of frauds issue aside, I still think that the presence of this oral modification is essentially irrelevant to the obligation to pay rent.
If we just look at the, just a portion of the testimony, certainly the jury heard conflicting testimony and based on the verdict, credited the respondent's testimony with respect to many of these details. But Kyle Stromstad testified that he told Mr. Walters he would be delivering grain to both elevators, both the West Central and CHS. And it seems like Mr. Walters was a little bit unclear about that, but then later remembered that he had been told that grain would be going to CHS. And then Kyle testified, as I understand it, too, that he told Mr. Walters three times he needed to open up an account there so that this could all be processed properly. And of course, that never occurred, as we know. But he did recall, Mr. Walters did recall subsequently that he was told to open up an account. And it seemed like there was clear testimony from the insurance expert, or I don't remember her name now, but that, someone could not open an account for someone else. It had to be done by Mr. Walters specifically, which of course then he failed to do. So, acting in concert with this modification and knowing that Green was going to both elevators. I mean, to me, it seems like it comes down to a jury's determination of who was credible and, you know, how this played out so that Mr. Walters did not get the direct income from CHS.
Well, yes, Your Honor, there was a lot of conflicting evidence. I will acknowledge that. However, I would go back to the fact that this modification, I don't think relieved the obligation to pay rent. Now, I know that's not what the jury said. However, you know, this there wasn't essentially no evidence, and there was no jury instructions about excusing the obligation to pay rent. And that's where I think, although if we take that testimony as correct, and that's what the jury relied on, I believe that there's still an obligation there that Mr. Stromstad, Kyle Stromstad, still could have fulfilled this contract. And whether that's crediting corn to an account, which if that was not possible, there were other means to satisfy the contract, like paying proceeds directly to Mr. Walters. And I believe that is in the record. I don't unfortunately have a cite for that, but I believe there's testimony where Mr. Stromstad was asked if he could have paid Mr. Walters, and he didn't. So I think there was other means to actually fulfill this contract that weren't pursued that could have been.
Would you just clarify for me? I know there were issues about settlement negotiations, you know, that you've raised, but with respect to Ms. Tollison's testimony and the crop insurance that both parties maintained here, what did the jury know about that in terms of how that was ultimately resolved per party?
So I that's where I think things got a bit out of hand, and maybe that's not the correct phrase, but crop insurance was at issue. That was a poor crop year. That was undisputed. It was a drought year up in Polk County. Crop insurance was at play. Both parties were, I believe, put in claims, and that was knowingly going to come into evidence. However, the issue of whether parties would receive that coverage, I didn't anticipate coming out, but it did come out. And that's part of the reason I note some of these improper remarks at trial being misconduct. And that was one. I think that got out of hand. I think the jury may certainly have relied on, well, Mr. Walters may have received crop insurance coverage or will receive crop insurance coverage. What's the point of us being here?
But counsel, reviewing the transcript, it looked like, actually, it looked like trial counsel did a pretty good job of objecting over and over to any references to any settlement agreements and really kind of nipped it in the bud. So, I mean, it didn't, what did, I'm curious as to, well, I'll leave it at that. But actually, if I could, I just want to go back and have a follow-up question. To what Judge Hallbrooks, when she was talking about the evidence, and that there seemed to be a lot of evidence, conflicting evidence. And JMOL, case law has said that basically that's only appropriate when the evidence is overwhelming on one side, such that reasonable minds could not differ. And if there's conflicting evidence, then why wasn't the district court's ruling on the JMOL proper then, if there was all this conflicting evidence?
And again, I know, I realize there is a lot of conflicting evidence in the record, but what I think is the key material evidence that was not conflicted was the non-payment of rent. You know, I can direct the court, I won't read it here, but I can direct the court to pages 330 to 331 and 573 to 574 of the transcript. That's where those questions are asked of Mr. Stromstad about the corn that went to this grain elevator that was not credited to Mr. Walters. And those are the material facts not in dispute that I believe do support judgment as a matter of law.
So, counsel, though, if assuming there was an oral modification, wouldn't Mr. Walters have had an, wasn't there a kind of a condition precedent to performance by the, well, anyway, wouldn't he have had an obligation to open the account before there's an obligation to perform by respondents.
Well, and that's the tricky part, Your Honor, because I guess the terms of this oral modification, I think the record, it's pretty clear from the record, were unclear about what the party was to do with the grain accounts. And so whether it created a condition precedent to performance, I don't know if the record supports that. I don't know if that was Mr. Stromstad's intent to by telling Mr. Walters, hey, go create an account. Otherwise, you're not getting your corn this year.
Well, but didn't wasn't there a it seems like there was a modification by performance, and it seems fairly straightforward that in order to get paid, you open up an account with one of the grain elevators, whether it's the one that he went to regular or whether it's CHS. And those were the two known grain elevators that would be receiving it. But in order to get paid, you have to open up an account with one of them, correct?
Well, I think from the grain elevator, yes, that is true. And that's what, admittedly, the parties were doing with West Central throughout the life of the contract. However, I guess my argument is that it's not impossible for the Stromsteads to perform, to pay rent, in spite of not having an account. They can still fulfill, they could write a check, they could pay rent that way. It doesn't have to be through the grain elevator. And in the agreement, and obviously with the oral modification, it might be different, but with the agreement itself, it does not provide a method of payment, whether it's through the grain elevator or otherwise.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
And you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll now turn to counsel for respondent. We have the clock set for you. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing. You may begin.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Granger, and I represent the respondents in this case, Kyle Stromstad and Bruce Stromstad. Of course, there has to be a condition precedent. The contract itself, the allegations are not that the corn should have been dumped upon the front yard of the appellants. There has to be some kind of accommodation or somewhere to put this grain. Its delivery is not defined as dumping the corn on his front yard or a specific elevator. Nothing of those things. Now,
Counsel, for there to be an oral modification, would you agree that there has to be clear and convincing evidence to support the modification?
yes, Your Honor, absolutely, and there was in this case. There may have been some dispute over whether or not corn could be delivered to CHS. However, there was no testimony. There was only testimony that there was conflicting testimony, but the jury believed that Kyle Stromstad instructed him to open up an account in CHS because he would be going to one of two grain elevators, depending on which lines were shorter. And he advised them where he was going to be taking it. He advised them to open up an account there. He advised my client advised Larry to open an account at CHS. Larry even remembers such instruction. Now, why else would he give that instruction? He's not giving instructions to every single person that he passes on the street that, hey, open an account at CHS.
Does Larry, I mean, does, sorry, does Kyle telling Larry to open an account amount an amount to an agreement to modify? In other words, one person telling another to do something?
If I believe under this case, it's consistent with with the practice that's been
A
going
past
on.
practice.
Their practice was to deliver the corn to a grain elevator. Kyle then informed Larry which grain elevators he would be using and instructed him to make sure that there's an account there. Certainly, Larry has some kind of an obligation to speak up or duty to speak up and say, I don't want mine to go to CHS, or I'm not going to open an account there. There was no testimony as to any of that. And there was no reason to think that. This was consistent with the past conduct. Maybe they switched an elevator too, but that's what happened at the first time too. And again, there has to be some kind of obligation by Larry. Opposing counsel would have you believe that because Larry might not have been allocated all the corn, case closed. We lose because he didn't get his corn. ignoring any and all obligations that Larry may have. Now, how does that work? What if he were to receive instruction on, I don't know, I want my money to be placed in the mailbox in my front door. And he locked the door. That's essentially what we have here, is it made it impossible for my client to deliver the rent.
But let's take that hypothetical a step further, okay? Because it seems that even if we assume that there's a modification, it's a modification to how the contract is performed. But I don't, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's no dispute that appellants were entitled to 1/3 of the proceeds from the sale of the grain, correct?
Right, that's not disputed.
Okay, so if the contract says they are entitled, who cares if that payment is made by a check, credit card, cash? Isn't respondent still entitled to compensate appellants under the agreement, regardless of whether or not it's been modified in terms of how that payment is made?
I think the contract, I haven't been posed the question. I didn't go back and look to see if a monetary payment would suffice. I think the contract, in order to make a monetary payment, I think that would require a modification as well. The corn was, he was entitled to 1/3 the corn. I would also pose another hypothetical. What if the reverse was true? What if by some error at CHS or West Central, or even Kyle's own error? I mean, the jury found that Larry did not fulfill all his obligations by not opening an account. Regardless, opposing counsel seems to think that if Larry didn't get his corn, then everything falls on Kyle. It doesn't matter that Larry settled his accounts. It doesn't matter that he was provided the info or is given access to all of the information to review that before he settled his insurance claims, which, by the way, limited my client's ability to make an insurance claim because Larry settled on his. So let's take a look at another hypothetical. Let's say that Larry received too much corn. Let's say that an error was made and maybe a phone call or the message didn't get through to the right people at CHS and Larry received too much corn. Would he automatically be susceptible to suing because he just by default received too much corn?
Well, it seems that logical that if he received too much corn, he would have to compensate respondents per the agreement because he's only entitled to 1/3, not 2/3 or the entire amount. I mean, I'm struggling with. It seems like it's not disputed that respondents received a benefit over and above what they were entitled to under the agreement. Under what legal theory do they get to keep what they were not entitled to under the contract?
What I would say, Your Honor, is this, is that it's not clear which specific, I would put it in terms of which specific duties exist with each person and which person breached that duty that led to the non-payment of the corn and the non-allocation of that corn. My client grew the corn as he was supposed to. He advised Larry where he would be taking the corn. He advised Larry to open an account at CHS and he instructed CHS to make those allocations when delivered there. Larry only had one obligation to do. That was to open an account. That was the sole reason why he didn't receive his allocation. And as far as making good on it, opposing counsel just said that he could have paid, he could have made corrections and so forth. But this is the very same thing that he's objecting to as well. He's making a claim for unjust enrichment, which it contains the element that my client cannot wrongfully retain that benefit. But retaining it, Larry wouldn't take it back. My client tried to make the accommodations and tried to make those things. Now, all
well,
of those
doesn't that go to the whole settlement issue, which is something that the district court said it needed to be excluded?
But that's where, I mean, I think that that did get a little gray because there were mitigation of damages issues. There was the settlement of the corn contract or the insurance contract, and there was also an element that related to the retention portion of unjust enrichment.
Wouldn't that information, even just enough of that to get into the jury, couldn't that have unduly influenced the jury to think, well, what's the harm here? Even if there was a breach of contract, they weren't harmed because they got the benefit from the insurance coverage. So why should they, from the jury's perspective, why wouldn't they look at that and say, you know, this is just a wash? And yeah, okay, maybe they might have breached the contract, maybe not. But everybody was compensated because of the insurance claims that had been submitted. Why isn't that evidence, even just a little bit, getting in front of the jury? Why isn't that enough to say, you know what, this really shouldn't stand at all? Because ultimately, there's no dispute that the contract terms in terms of with respect to what benefits the parties should have received, that was never modified at all, and the parties seem to agree on that.
So, Your Honor, I think that there's some gray there. I do, but the judge in her memo mapped all that out very clearly. She gave the instructions, and under case law, the jurors are presumed to follow those instructions. And those instructions were given. There are also competing elements because some of that information does go to the claim that they're trying to make of unjust enrichment, that he wrongfully retained it. But if Larry is not allowing them to give it back, he's not wrongfully retaining anything. He's not wrongfully retaining it if the offer was made, listen, whatever you need, we'll give it, we'll make that adjustment. You didn't open an account, go open an account and we'll make that adjustment. If Larry refuses to correct his error, and refuses to do all of those things necessary in order to receive it, then that's a breach on his duty to make things necessary in order to receive that payment. And that's a duty that my client does not have, in fact, cannot perform that. My client cannot open up an account on behalf of CHS for Larry. My client cannot do some of those things. It was incumbent and required by Larry to do it, and he didn't have a problem doing it when he was told to open up an account. He didn't object to that. So all of these things have to be taken into consideration. And so by restricting
But are
everything
you
on,
talking
I'm,
about, and just to be clear, are you talking about actions that were taken after the lawsuit was filed in order to settle the case?
No, Your Honor, I'm talking about actions taken almost immediately. Well, first of all, we're talking about a lawsuit that was commenced within just a couple of months of harvest. But even before that, even before the trial was commenced, even before the action was commenced, those efforts were made. And that does go to the retention part of unjust enrichment. So weighing all of the equities and weighing what the jury is charged with, the judge determined to allow some evidence of the attempts to make good on it to make sure that my client was not wrongfully retaining anything. And also following her instructions, and again, this is all very well laid out in the court's memorandum.
So, in your view, was any of the 408 evidence presented to the jury? Did the jury hear any of the act details of the actual settlements? I know there were a number of questions going to settlement efforts, and there were objections that were sustained by the judge, but did the jury hear any of the details of the any settlement discussions?
I think, Your Honor, in order to answer that question definitively, it would require a determination of what is a 408 evidence and what is other evidence toward mitigation of damages, as well as the retention portion of unjust enrichment. However, what I would say is, under my understanding of a settlement negotiations, none of that was introduced in the court, and the court did not hear any of that.
The jury didn't hear that.
I'm sorry. The jury did not hear
Okay,
any of
thank
that.
you.
Mostly, Your Honors, I believe I'm probably going to rely upon the court's opinion. Again, I thought it was very thorough. It was supported. It tied it all up. He did not retain a benefit wrongfully. We can't ignore the obligations that Larry had and seemingly agreed to. We can't just ignore those things. He never testified that he did not want Korn to go to CHS. He never said that. He also never said where the he never made the assumption, or he never described the contract as demanding that the corn itself be delivered to Larry's bins on his farm site or his yard or wherever. Something needs to happen, and they had that agreement and they had a process. And Kyle told him exactly where he was going to take it. The jury believed that. Kyle told him exactly what to do. The jury believed that. Larry didn't do it. And then Larry did not allow the adjustments to be made in order to make good on it. In fact, he settled his insurance claim that was determined or made an offer of based on the scale sheets and everything, and the scale tickets and the deposits. If that was faulty, Larry had an obligation to review that before he signed off on all the insurance claims. He looked at it, he had an opportunity. The insurance company said that he was afforded an opportunity to review everything beforehand. Where's Larry's obligation here? Where are his obligations? He has some. To say that he has none, that he doesn't have to do anything, and then put it all on Kyle? No, that can't happen. The payment of the corn could not happen under this case. And then when it was discovered, Larry refused to take it back. I don't know what more you could expect from Kyle.
Well, the payment could not have occurred through CHS if appellants had not opened the account, but does that necessarily exclude any other opportunities? I mean, you're referring to the attempts to compensate before. So there could have been other ways to have made the payment, correct?
Well, you're assuming, though, that again, Kyle even knew about it. Kyle did everything that he was supposed to do. He delivered it where he said he was going to deliver it. He instructed CHS to make the splits that he wanted him to make. And then as soon as it was brought to his attention that it might not be right, Larry wouldn't take it back. Larry wouldn't take the corn from Kyle. Wouldn't make any of those adjustments. And all of that matters. You can't just blame Kyle when the error of not receiving the corn relates back to Larry's oversight and his miss, and then no efforts or no there's no allowance for an adjustment to be made when the error originated with Larry, and then Kyle's not permitted to make any corrections. That really puts Kyle in a box. That puts him in a box he can't get out of.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
You're 15 minutes up and you went a little bit over, but I wanted to let you finish that thought there. We will now return to appellant for 5 minutes of rebuttal. We have the time on the clock, and counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you. And I'll discuss directly the issue of the settlement negotiations. I don't believe the record supports accommodations were made prior to the lawsuit. I think a review of the record shows that the only offers that were made after the lawsuit commenced. The lawsuit commenced, I'll note for the court that docket number 4 of this case indicates Mr. Kyle Stromstad was served on January 26, 2022. There is no evidence in the record of any offers before then. The only evidence in the record of anything trying to be resolved by the parties is Exhibit 14. That was Mr. Stromstad's letter to Larry Walters, where he tells Larry Walters, "You got your corn." It's Exhibit 14, it's the second to last paragraph. "You got your corn." That's what he tells Mr. Walters before he sues. There was no other offers. The only other offers were made subsequent to the lawsuit. Those were all kept out. Those were attempted to be put into evidence, but objections were made. Now, I understand that presumed jurors understand the instructions they're given, but they're people. They also can pick up on these references to, what did you do to correct that, Mr. Stromstad? Did you offer that? Those were the types of questions that were asked. They were asked more than once harassed 8 times, in addition to references to prospective crop insurance coverage that Mr. Walters would receive. I think that surely could prejudice a jury to think, hey, this guy, this Kyle Stromstad, offered to do something. Why are we here? This could have been taken care of. There's a reason those are not allowed. But the jury got to hear some of that.
Counsel, you noted that the offers were kept out after the objections were sustained by the district court. But can you respond to the argument by Mr. Granger that the line is kind of blurry between mitigation of, you know, evidence regarding mitigation of damages, the duty to mitigate, and the unjust enrichment theory as well, versus evidence that is a falls within 408?
Sure. So with, I think the offers that were referenced were directed towards settlement. Now, I'm not sure where mitigation comes into play here. This was a contract where the Stromsteds were obligated to deliver the gross proceeds to Mr. Walters. I'm not sure what he has to do to mitigate. If an offer was made to say, here's your corn, those were only made after the lawsuit commenced. So I think there is a clear line of when settlement offers kick in. I mean, I from my understanding, they can kick in even before a lawsuit's commenced. But in this case, nothing was offered until the case was sued out. And so I think this case, even if there's some gray area in general, this case, I think there is black and white. And the offers that were at least attempted to be used at trial were settlement offers. Lastly, I would just like to touch on briefly the motion to amend the pleadings. I know that was one thing I indicated I wanted to speak on today. I'll be brief. That this is purely a legal question that I raise. This was one raised pre-trial and post-trial about adding a claim of civil theft. I think in this case, the district court applied too high of a standard, essentially weighing the legal viability of a claim, which to my understanding is more in tune to a motion to dismiss or summary judgment rather than an amendment standard. So in this case, I believe the district court erroneously applied the law to this amendment, and it should be reversed. And with all other respects, I would just ask the court to grant the relief in the brief. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your oral arguments and your briefing. The case is submitted, and we will be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory timeframe.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Thank you.